Welcome to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. We have not one but two guests on the show this evening as we delve into a conversation that to this day can make some people still feel a little uncomfortable. It's a frank discussion about mental health and those in our community living with schizophrenia and complex mental health difficulties. And while the stigma associated with these diagnoses has in some ways eased over the years, there is still much to be done to end mental health inequity, discrimination and exclusion. That has been the focus of an organisation called SANE for the past 36 years, and it is my pleasure to welcome the co-founder of SANE, Dr. Margaret Leggett, and SANE's CEO, Rachel Green, to Great Australian Lives. Ladies, how are you? We'll start with you, Rachel.
I'm great. It's great to be here. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you. And Dr. Margaret Leggett, thank you for being with us.
I'm very pleased to be here with you. And yes, I'm extremely fit and well and ready to go.
Oh, that is so good to hear. I love it when someone answers that way. Fit and well, that's awesome. Now, Doctor, I'm going to call you Dr. Margie. SANE, what does it stand for, first of all?
Well, it originally stood for four letters, S.A.N.E, and that stood for Schizophrenia, a National Emergency. And that organisation was started in the UK. And when I was working in this area, I'd heard about the organisation and what it was trying to do. So I went over to England and looked at their work and was extremely impressed. So we came back and we got the organisation SANE started in Australia. It was originally S.A.N.E, but as we were coming and talking out about schizophrenia, and that really was our purpose, because this illness had been hidden and most people still wanted it hidden. But the people that I was working with were families who had a son or daughter with this diagnosis, and also the people themselves with the diagnosis. We said, no, we're sick of being in the shadows. We don't want to be hidden. Mm. We want this brought out into the open. We want people to know about it, to accept it, to know that it's an illness, that these are not totally mad people who are mad for their lives. That's not the situation at all. We can treat this illness and people can go back and be ordinary members of the community. So that was our aim. But we struck a tremendous amount of opposition. And that, I think, was because the stigma, and when I say stigma, stigma is based on ignorance. And it was just absolute ignorance about this condition and what it meant. So we were going to change all that. So our whole aim was to say, right, we're bringing it out into the open, in spite of the opposition that we received from, all sorts of people, and particularly people working in psychiatric services. I mean, I remember being rung up by a psychiatric nurse at one of our clinics, and she absolutely rounded on me and said, what on earth do you think you're doing? You can't talk about this. This has to stay hidden. It's so awful. It was a struggle. We really had to be so strong, but we were. And the strongest people were the people with the illness themselves and their families who were trying to look after them without any support, without really getting information about the illness. Families were in a terrible situation, really, because they knew they didn't know what was happening to their sons and daughters. They didn't know how to handle it properly. They needed help. They needed support, and they weren't getting it. It was a very stimulating time for me, actually, because there was this sort of, I think, rebellion, you might like to call it, from people who had the illness and certainly from their families as well.
And now, Dr. Margie, you talking about when, you know, in the 1970s when you were doing your PhD, mm-hmm. Is that before the period of time that you're talking about?
Goodness me, look, I go back a terribly long way, Laura. it's a very complicated history. I'll try and be as brief as I can. But I trained as an occupational therapist and worked in psychiatric hospitals here and in Canada. So I knew what it was really like at the grassroots level. And then I went to Monash because I thought we need to know very much more about what's happening. This was at the time when Western countries particularly were closing down all the very big psychiatric hospitals. And people were, now, it was now thought that, you know, people can be treated in the community. We don't need those old loony bins, those terrible places where people were just incarcerated for life. But what care in the community really meant was care by families. And that, as I've said already, families were given this huge task of trying to care.
I kind of was heading towards that question of describing those institutions in the 70s, and you sort of, you've done that.
That's right.
They sound like they were shocking places, you know, where people were sort of just left to, you know, finish their lives in what you call a loony bin. I mean, it sounds awful. Can you tell me, was it everyone who suffered mental illness who was put in an institution like that?
Pretty well. And it wasn't only people just with mental illness. It was people who were alcoholics, perhaps, people with intellectual disabilities. Those institutions catered for people who were, I don't like the word, but were seen, I suppose, as misfits or were nuisances. So we just wanted them, you know, put away out of sight. And that's what happened. Mm. But for many people, some of those institutions were real places of asylum, particularly if you were in a community that wasn't going to accept different behaviour, I like to call it. So being in those institutions wasn't all bad for some people. In fact, the book that my friend Sandy, who's had schizophrenia since she was 17 and is now 65, we wrote a book together a couple of years ago, and it was called Out of the Madhouse. And we interviewed 80 people, former residents, staff, and families who'd had something to do with this hospital called Larundel. And what surprisingly came out for us was that so many of them reported on what tremendous care they had actually received in the institution. They were safe. Mm. They had three meals a day. There were activities at the place every day of the week. So those big institutions weren't all bad, even though they had the reputation of being very bad. Once in the community, many people with mental illness did not get the sort of care they got in the big institutions. And what distresses me very much these days is that so many people with mental illness, because there aren't those support services in the community, are homeless. And the number of mentally ill people in jail at the moment is just an absolute disgrace. And that's because they're not getting the supports they need. Mm.
I tend to agree with that, with my experience with people who suffer from mental illness. Mm-hmm. It's, I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm absolutely no expert, but I feel like we've gone too far the other way. You touched earlier on the burden on families. And as you say, some people with mental illness can find themselves homeless or in jail. I mean, that is just so sad. What this is a huge question, but do you agree that we've gone too far the other way?
Yes.
And how do we, so what, I mean, we can't really introduce these institutions again. What's the answer?
Well, we have gone far, far, far too much the other way. We really have. And I think, as I said, I think it's an absolute disgrace. How are we going to reverse that? Look, I'm really not too sure. You stated at the beginning of this interview that, you know, the stigma was much less these days. The stigma for conditions like anxiety and depression is much, much, much better. But you hear people talking about anxiety and depression. You still don't hear people talking about schizophrenia. It is still hidden. And I think it's equally as bad as it has ever been. Which is why I think we again have to bring these conditions out into the open and start talking about them. Now, there are several things. One of the first things is that people should be able to be in supported housing. And it's because so many people are homeless that they steal, they commit crimes, and that's why they get put into jail. If they were in supported housing, that wouldn't happen. everybody is entitled to have a home, but we don't give the seriously mentally ill people a home. That's a terrible thing. So that's one of the first things that really does have to happen. And then, of course, we have to bring in all of these psychosocial supports that people need. And we know they work. I mean, when I was head of the organisation I started called the Schizophrenia Fellowship of Victoria, we set up supported housing, and we found that people then did not have any more episodes because they were looked after. Their illness didn't deteriorate, so they didn't have any more episodes. Yes. They had something to do. And with some of the services we set up, we got people back to university. Students could go back to learning. We got people doing voluntary work. We got people back into work. So what makes me so angry and really depressed is that we know that this can happen for people with serious, complex mental health issues. They don't have to have serious, complex mental health issues all their lives. But that's what's happening at the moment, and I find it very, very sad.
It is very sad, Doctor. And as someone who had a sister who had very serious mental health problems, who has now passed away, I can fully appreciate exactly what you're talking about, and for families, that sense of just you don't know where to turn, you don't a lot of the help is not real help, the lines are so long, and you know, for some, sadly, my family, it you know, it all ends up being too late. You mentioned before that schizophrenia, you know, is still a big bad wolf. It's still very taboo. We don't talk about it. We have made some progress in other areas, though, haven't we, since the 70s and 80s when you, you know, you started out?
Oh, yes, we certainly have made progress. For instance, one of the things that I really think has been quite amazing is that people themselves are prepared to talk about their illness now, come out and say what it's all about. In our psychiatric services, we now employ people with mental illness. They're actually on the staff, and we're also employing family members in our services too, so that alongside, you know, clinical people, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, we do now have people who provide what we call peer support, because I think that possibly is one of the most important things that's happened over the years, that people who've been through these experiences know better than anybody how to help other people who are going through those experiences. So that's a huge change. And one of the things I was just contemplating this the other day, when I started SANE, it was a time when we just did not talk about schizophrenia or mental illness generally. And I had to go and find important people who could help me start this organisation. And the people I found were very successful businessmen who happened to have a son or daughter with schizophrenia. And they were very good at getting money, because there was absolutely no way governments would give me money in those days.
Yeah.
Now, the first board of SANE was just businessmen, psychiatrists, myself, and that wonderful woman, Anne Deverson, who many of us have known and respect so broadly. We now have people with mental illness themselves on the board of SANE, and that is an extraordinary progression, and I find that really fantastic, because way back in the early 80s when we started SANE, that would never have happened. So that transition for me has been fantastic.
Good. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight, a mental health pioneer, Dr. Margaret Leggett, co-founder of SANE, and SANE's CEO, Rachel Green, and more with them in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guests tonight are both from SANE, Australia's leading national mental health organisation for people with complex mental health issues, and their friends and family who support them. Now, Rachel Green is with us at the moment. She is CEO. Rachel, can you explain what complex mental health issues are? I mean, we hear about mental health issues and then we hear the word complex. There's obviously a difference.
Yeah, look, I'll do my best. It's complicated to explain, we sometimes
complex,
like to say.
Complex, maybe?
I guess in very simple terms, you know, we know from the data that one in five people will experience a mental health issue, you know, during each year. So that's 20% of the population will have some experience. But the more common mental health issues often get more of the attention and more of the funding. So things like depression, anxiety, which are less likely to be enduring or have really severe impacts. So when we say complex mental health issues, we mean, you know, a group of mental health issues or a combination of factors that mean someone is more likely to have a really difficult time. It might be something that lasts for a longer period that requires more support, but that also, you know, people can recover from, and that's often the missing piece. So, you know, specifically we might be talking about, for example, schizophrenia, be just over 100,000 people in Australia, you know, based on the latest data, that might be living with that. Things like PTSD, obsessive compulsive disorder, bipolar, and you know, more complex presentations of anxiety and depression, so depressive disorders or generalized anxiety disorder. We'd also include within complex, you know, people who are autistic, people with intellectual disability, who have a really hard time getting just general mental health support. So yeah. We like to say complex is not that complicated at SANE, because actually what people often need when they're dealing with, you know, more severe and persistent mental health issues is better social connections and wraparound support and, you know, things like housing and support to stay in work and get back into work. But yeah, so it's a definition we like to use to really indicate that for us, that's where we specialise. There are a lot of organisations who are doing general mental health awareness, and you know, anyone in the community can experience feelings of anxiety or feelings of depression and sadness. Those are fairly normal feelings. It's when it becomes a more enduring mental health issue that requires, you know, what we believe really requires more intensive support. That's when you kind of come within our definition, yes, of complex.
Right. Now, just getting to know you a bit more, Rachel, you grew up in Canberra. You're a Canberra girl. What are your memories from childhood?
Yeah, born and bred in Canberra. It's funny. My lifetime spans a lot of big changes in mental health in Australia. I grew up and had an experience of poor mental health myself, and one that would probably not be that uncommon. But in, you know, when I was in my sort of early teens, things like Headspace didn't exist. You know, there was just around the time of early reforms to make just psychological therapies more accessible. And so, you know, the system that I was able to access back then looked very different to how it looks now. But I think one of the important points is that for people with more complex mental health issues, it hasn't actually necessarily changed all that much. And, you know, if I think back to being, you know, 12 and 13 and really struggling, you know, by 15, I'd moved out of home, and it was really my mum's support that kept me safe through, you know, what were some quite difficult years as a teenager in my early 20s. And I suppose that does really drive me in this role now. I meet a lot of mums who are supporting, you know, younger people in their family and you know, young women who are really struggling, and you know, it really gets to me, you know, trying to say to them it can be okay, you know, hang in there, keep doing it, but also it shouldn't be as hard as it is, I think.
Absolutely.
That, I suppose, is the big driver for me, is that it's still, you know, mums and dads and brothers and sisters and partners kind of holding things together instead of being able to access the support they need. And I kind of look at my journey relative to some of the other stories that are unfortunately all too common, where you hear stories of young people who've had difficulties with their mental health and things have just progressed down a path. And unfortunately, our mental health system still works kind of backwards. To get more support, more comprehensive support, we have to get really all the way worse. It has to just really decline to a point of
absolutely
being permanent before you get wraparound support.
Yes, no, that is absolutely true. Did you find it hard to get help and support when you had your lived experience?
The things we talk about now that are sort of just starting to be things that exist and are still not accessible enough didn't exist then at all. So
yeah, you mentioned Headspace.
I struggled with maintaining friendships and relationships, and struggled with being in and out of work and being safe, and struggled with housing. And back then, and I guess even still today, there weren't really programs or community services. I mean, what there was in Canberra at the time was a fairly thriving kind of network of youth centres, which I leaned on fairly heavily, partly because they also involved music, and I was a musician at the time, and that was a place you could get gigs. And it's funny, only looking back on it now do I see that their program of supporting bands to, you know, probably some god-awful punk music, play their shows, it's actually a very clever way of getting young people in the door of a youth centre, and therefore being able to keep an eye on us, really. And I think there's a real danger, and I say this as a leader of a digital service, as we increasingly move things online, that we don't accidentally allow that to defund place-based services.
Yes.
People need places to go, and it's really important that we continue to invest in a whole range of place-based services. And I suppose it's saying that's why, you know, we're really focused as a digital organisation on being connected with the people working on the ground, not trying to make any claims of replacing things.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Rachel Green, who is the CEO of SANE. Rachel, was there a diagnosis for you in your 20s? And when, and if there was, did it help you to have a name? And did you, sort of two-pronged question, were you comfortable with talking about it?
I'm still not super comfortable with talking about it. And it's funny because I do talk about it, and I can talk about it from a place of relative safety because I'm a CEO, have a good income, I have a board that's happy with what I'm doing. If I was a, you know, frontline checkout chick at Woolies, probably would be nowhere near as comfortable. I think it's really important to recognise that for many people, that comfort isn't there. But did I have a diagnosis? I had several. I sometimes talk about the charm bracelet with other people who've, you know, had an experience of the mental health system. Diagnosis in mental health isn't an exact kind of science. It's a bit more of an art. And often I think one of the things we don't talk about enough, particularly for young women, is the sort of intersection, and young men, of hormones, the general challenges of it being a young person combined with understanding symptoms of what might be happening, as well as things like, you know, hormonal changes and nutrition. So, I've had various diagnoses of, generalized anxiety disorder and ADHD that at times are meaningful to me, but also at times I think it's really important that we don't, build our identities solely around a diagnosis and a label, because really what's important in the moment is, have you got people around you who support you? Have you, you know, are you able to get what you need to live a contributing life, to live an everyday life? And that's kind of actually often less about diagnosis. Certainly what's really important for particularly younger people when they're first facing some sort of mental health diagnosis is support and understanding, what is this thing, how will I manage it? And getting that from other peers who have some of the same issues as you can be extremely powerful, but also we need to make sure that there's a community response that ensures people continue to feel welcome.
Yeah, having that connection, absolutely. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guests tonight are two trailblazing women, the co-founder of SANE, Dr. Margaret Leggett, and SANE CEO Rachel Green, and we'll find out more about some of the ways that SANE is supporting women with complex mental health issues in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tonight we are exploring the work of SANE with co-founder Dr. Margaret Leggett and SANE's CEO Rachel Green. Now, SANE's tagline is people like us. Dr. Margie, tell us about that simple phrase and what that's all about.
Well, I think the problem has always been that, you know, once you were diagnosed with a mental illness, you were then ostracized and you were seen as you were probably seen as mad and in many instances bad as well. So you were mad and bad. So you were somebody who was, you know, not to be accepted as a fit person for society. And we're trying very, very hard to say that is absolutely all wrong. I think one of the things about labels that is interesting, particularly with schizophrenia, which continues to be extraordinarily controversial as a diagnosis, but I remember very many people when they were actually told that they had an illness called schizophrenia, that they were able to say, I have an illness. It is an illness. I am not bad. Mm. And my illness may result in me behaving in ways that are very distressing for me and very distressing for the people around me because they don't understand it. And people with schizophrenia who hear voices in their head a lot of the time telling them to do awful things or telling them that they're a horrible person, etc., etc., that to be able to say that this was an illness, not that they were just behaving badly, you know, was a relief for them. But then we've still got this word schizophrenia that I believe very strongly that we should be describing what we mean by that word or what the word actually says, because in many ways it describes a lot of the symptoms and characteristics of the illness. But it's controversial. A lot of people want the word changed. There are movements around the world all the time. Let's get rid of the word. It's too stigmatizing. We'll never get over the stigma. That's not the way I go. I go the other way. But as I say, it's extremely controversial.
Yeah, it's a little bit, well, very much like the treatment of those who suffer from drug addiction.
Yes.
They can be called a druggo.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's an illness.
Yes, it is.
Just the same.
Yes.
Now, for those in our society, Rachel Green, who, you know, might be seeking support or if they have a family member with, you know, complex mental health issues, what can SANE do for them?
So SANE for a long time has been, you know, a really powerful national advocate on complex mental health issues. And one of the things we do for the community, have done for a long time, is actually provide information and resources via our website, sane.org. But, very exciting for us, in the middle of last year, we actually got some funding to scale up a helpline we've been operating for 20 years and turn that into a really comprehensive support service that we actually designed with people who have schizophrenia and have complex mental health issues, designed with people who are family and carers, designed with people who are autistic, people with intellectual disability, people from different cultural backgrounds. And what we're able to do now is work as part of the health system. So, you know, we all know there are a lot of kind of national helplines and people have different experiences with those, but they mostly work in a really brief, one-off kind of way. They're going to check if you're safe and essentially send you to your GP, beyond which often people find it hard to get any support. And there's, you know, huge waiting lists at the moment. So what we're doing instead is actually working with you, with your GP, with your support team that can be people from your family. You can choose who to add in. We've built a portal that's designed around the individual's needs. We can work with them on developing a recovery plan. And that recovery plan might include, for example, weekly counselling, weekly peer support sessions, and joining some of the online groups that we facilitate, much like we're doing this call now, so people can join into a group discussion. And those are a mix of what we call psychoeducational, so learning about things that might help, so talking about sleep and your mental health, managing your medication, having relationships, and talking about your mental illness. And also just generally social, because for a lot of people with complex mental health issues, isolation is a huge issue. I mean, I talked before about, you know, how my mum was a really big supporter for me. A lot of people, they don't have that. And really, really wicked parts of mental illness is that it breaks down your family relationships. So for a lot of people, they don't have someone who's going to check in on them and they don't have social connection. A response to a major national study in survey of high impact psychosis And one of the data points that's stuck with me since the report, I didn't work for SANE at the time and I've carried it all these years, 1 in 8 people reported having no friends at all. And that's really powerful. And we talked before about how people with schizophrenia are perceived. And this is the really pernicious effect that stigma has in the way it others people. And I think people have this idea in their mind of a guy on a bus with, you know, no teeth and he's homeless and he's scary. And that comes from terrible portrayals in the media. But people forget that someone with a complex mental health issue is the loved, you know, promising 17-year-old in the family. You know, symptoms can emerge really quite suddenly in late teens, early 20s. And these are the loved babies. They deserve just as much, you know, support and human rights as anyone else. But I think the way that stigma has really pervaded our society, and actually one of the challenges of our focus on depression, anxiety, and normalizing that is that it's almost further othered people with complex mental health issues. And we've really got to change that and challenge that and reverse it. And part of how we do that is talking about it more.
Well, this is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives, and a little more in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tonight we are exploring the work of SANE with co-founder Dr. Margaret Leggett and SANE's CEO, Rachel Green. Dr. Margie, there's some really incredible testimonials on the SANE website from people, you know, from all walks of life, talking about their own journey with mental health. As a founder, you'd have to be really proud of those people and happy with the fact that they are talking about it and that they're there for other people to, you know, feel more comfortable about themselves with reading.
Oh, yes, I think that is absolutely vital and must be increased. Can I just perhaps go back to something that Rachel said? Because she said that mental illness tears families apart. And that is so true. And that was one of the things that I was really determined that SANE would maybe do something about. Now, one of the things that I did, I had heard about research that was being done, particularly in the UK and in America, where they were, as a mental illness was developing in a son or daughter, they would start right from the very beginning to include the family members, so that the family members at the very beginning were given information, education in ways of how to help their sons and daughters. And this research went on and showed that if you do that in the very, very early stages, that you can prevent hugely disruptive breakdowns. You can stop people from having to go in and out of hospital. The research results have been absolutely extraordinary. And some of the research results also went through the cost-effectiveness of all of this and found that involving the families and helping the families saved mental health services incredible amounts of money. Yeah. Now, that research has been written up in all of the very important journals, but is it actually happening? Are families being involved to this extent? And I think I have to say, no, they are not. And I, for the life of me, really cannot understand that when all of the benefits are so are there for us to look at and know about. So my hope would be that rather than mental illness tearing families apart, as it still does, that, you know, this is one of the areas that we can really work with and get to change.
Yeah, Dr. Margaret, that is a really good point. I think in Australia, and I don't know whether this is the issue in America, and I'm going to open a can of worms that we don't have time to delve into, but I think a problem in Australia is privacy. If you have a child, a son or daughter, especially over 18, mm-hmm. You can't find out a lot of the time what's going on.
I know, that's an appalling excuse. That's an excuse for all of the professional people not to say anything to the families. Now, privacy and confidentiality for the person with the mental illness is incredibly important and we must respect that. But what these research studies did was at the very beginning, they would say to the person, now, who are the people that you would like to support you? And sometimes, I mean, there were family situations that were pretty horrendous, and they would say, well, I don't want my family involved, but I do have these good friends, and maybe, you know, we could include them. It's this business of stopping, as Rachel has been talking about, the unbelievable isolation and loneliness that happens for people with mental, complex mental health issues, that is totally, totally destructive.
Yes,
Just to jump in on that. There really are. It's not an unsolvable problem.
No.
If we treat privacy and confidentiality as a really black and white issue, we'll continue to struggle with this. But actually, you know, one of the things I love to talk about at SANE is how we're really comfortable in the nuance of things. And actually within our new service, we're really exploring and testing innovative ways of approaching this. We've got concepts we talk about like progressive consent. Mm-hmm. Someone might not initially want to sign up to a guided ongoing program of counselling. And so often what we try and do is just seek consent to give them a ring back in a week. Mm. Talk about the birthday card list. If someone says, I'm not having a good day today, I don't want to come anymore, I don't want to talk to this anymore, we say, well, can we keep you on our birthday card list so we can just follow up with you in a few months' time and see how you're doing? And that's still respecting choice and consent, but it also isn't arbitrarily, you know, discharging people from a program because they were having a bad day. And just as likely, you know, we can talk with someone when they're well and in a good space about safety and what they'd like us to do and how they'd like us to help should they become unwell, and kind of seek consent for different types of alerts in advance. These, you know, what we call an advanced care directive is totally possible. And I think the challenge is partly resourcing. You know, if you talk about where this really gets to be life and death is when you've got families sitting in an emergency department saying, my son or daughter is suicidal, please admit them. And the hospital is turning to the young person who's over 18 who says no, and they're letting them go. There are so many steps before that. We're a joined up system. We're advanced care directives. We're plans in place, and care coordination and follow through can help avert and avoid that situation and also plan for it with the right resourcing to do it. And I guess that's the thing that, you know, we're fighting in the long term against mental health inequity. If you actually look at Australia's mental health system, we have this NDIS scheme, which if you live long enough and progress all the way to the point where every clinician agrees it's permanent and irreversible, you make it into the door of the scheme and suddenly support coordination is possible and housing support is possible and support to build social relationships is possible within a plan. And it just stands to good bloody reason that doing some of these things a little earlier, earlier in the progression of mental illness, psychosocial disability can be preventable. But we don't have a system right now that's built around prevention and more comprehensive early intervention because these things are more expensive. So we'll be really interested to push that envelope and look at, you know, economic studies and outcome studies to try and show that better support earlier on can keep people in jobs and keep them in families and keep them well supported so that they don't lose the social skills and end up disadvantaged down the line to end up needing a scheme like the NDIS.
Yeah. It's been so fascinating and such an educational chat. Anyone listening tonight who wants more information, SANE.org. That's SANE.org if you want more information and assistance as well. Dr. Margaret Leggett and Rachel Green from SANE, thank you so much.
Thank you very much too. It's been
a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And if you've enjoyed our chat with Margaret and Rachel tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast wherever you get your good podcasts from. And of course, join me the same time next week when we celebrate another Great Australian Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.